We'll read from Daniel chapter 3 in just a moment. You can go ahead and swap over to the other slide. It's good to see everybody. We've got a good crowd here this morning. I did meet scattered visitors here and there. We certainly want to welcome you. Thankful that you made the effort to be here today. And it's always good to be with God's people, to remember His Son, to worship Him, and to study His Word. For those that are visiting, we are continuing a series in the book of Daniel. We are to Daniel chapter 3 this morning. And we've been talking about, not only in this 10:30 service with the Daniel series, but also in the 9 o'clock series, about life as an exile, life in Babylon. And this morning, we're going to look specifically at how to survive in a postmodern world. You could really say that all of these middle chapters of Daniel, Daniel chapter 2 through 7, have the same theme. I think that that was part of the reason this was given, was to prepare, not just prepare, but to equip God's people who were going through that traumatic experience in Babylon with the knowledge that God was still in control, that He had not been defeated in any way, that He was still sovereign over all these kingdoms, and especially Babylon, who had risen up against Him. But to remind them that God was still with them, that He had not forgotten them, and that to those who were faithful, to those who, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego here in chapter 3, or Daniel in chapter 6, that when they go to the lion's den, or when they go to the lion's, the fiery furnace, or when they go to the lion's den, they're not alone. That God is there with them. And we are facing particular challenges in our culture today that are not at all different from theirs. And this lesson could have gone any number of different directions, I'll just tell you. There's a lot in here about how to deal with life in your career, as we've heard Charlie talk about that. Ben is going to talk to us about music. Music is especially highlighted in this chapter. It's a big part of culture. And Colton is the one who has been tapped with the politics lesson. And this chapter is totally about politics. And I want to say all of that before we read, because this is a familiar story. It's a story that if you've grown up going to church, you probably heard it from the time that you were really little. But I want to encourage you to think about the fact that this is not a children's story. Great application, and I love the fact that our kids learn this story. This is a very grown-up, mature lesson about how we have to live in this world that is antagonistic to our faith. And so let's read chapter 3, Daniel, together, and then we'll talk about how we can survive in a postmodern world. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I've made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered that some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So, I don't know if you've seen this bumper sticker before, perhaps driving around. I think it's more popular a few years ago than it is today. I don't see it as often as I used to, but you get the point of this many-symboled word coexist with all of the religious symbols together. It is really a good way of explaining what the word pluralism means. What is pluralism? It's a condition in which numerous distinct ethnic, religious, or cultural groups are present and tolerated in a society, or the belief that such a condition is desirable or socially beneficial. There are certain practical reasons why a nation like Babylon would be tolerant of many different religions, and they were. They don't appear that way right here. We're going to talk about what's going on here in a minute. But Babylon was a very tolerant society in terms of religion. You remember the decree that the king signed in Daniel chapter 6? The decree said you could pray to no other god for 30 days. Only 30 days, which means that it was allowed at other times. And the reason why nations would have a policy like this is ultimately, what they wanted was for there to be peace and money coming into the coffers. They wanted people to pay their taxes. And the best way you can disturb the peace or get people to stop paying their taxes is you outlaw their religion. And so these nations who would go conquering all of these cities and states and nationalities, they would typically be very careful. The Romans, for example, when they took Jerusalem. Now, this is not the case in AD 70. The abomination of desolation was set up where it ought not to have been. But the Romans, when they came into Jerusalem, they were like, oh, look, temple, that's totally yours. We will not go there. We will not mess with your sacrifices. You worship your God however you want to. Because they don't want there to be problems. And that's why Pilate would do magnanimous things like setting some prisoner free during the feast of the Passover as a gesture of kindness and goodwill. It was all about making sure that stream of money keeps going to Rome or Babylon or whatever empire we're speaking of. And by the way, that is a fundamental foundation stone of our nation, is that we believe in religious tolerance. Right? That's one of the reasons we're told that people came to America to begin with, is we want freedom to worship our God in the way that we want. Of course, we weren't thinking of other gods. We were thinking about, we don't want a state telling us you have to be Lutheran or you have to be Episcopal or whatever, right? And so we even celebrate the idea that it's not going to be mandatory for school children to be taught from a religious book and enforced that they have to pray in a certain way. I understand the whole prayer in schools was a very unpopular thing, removing it in the 60s, but understand that if things change, prayer might take on a whole new meaning in schools. It's taking on a whole new meaning in Europe, you understand. And so imposing a certain religion is not, we believe, a good thing. Right, and so there is this idea of pluralism. There is a side negative part of pluralism that we need to understand, though. And that is, if the belief is, well, everyone should worship the way they want to, and it should not be state-imposed, what may be implied is that, well, all faiths are really equal. And that's the reason why we are pluralistic, because no one God is over other gods. There's no one truth. Now, sometimes, even in a pluralistic society, this can change, and it can become imposed. And that's what's going on here in chapter 3, you understand. This is not purely religious. And that point is made abundantly clear by the repetition. I hope you notice the repetition throughout the chapter of all of the governors and magistrates and Celtics. I mean, all these different governing rulers were called together because this was to be a call to allegiance to Babylon. Yes, we may all have our different gods that we bow down to, but this image is going to be put above all. Right? This is the one we're going to worship. This was a political ploy, and I think you can see from the extreme reaction of Nebuchadnezzar, this was not just political, it was personal. This is about him. And some commentators have suggested that there is a relationship between chapter 2 and chapter 3, which makes sense. Nebuchadnezzar may have been flattered when he was told in the interpretation, "You, O king, King of kings, Lord of lords, you, O king, are the head of gold." Oh, I am the head of gold, aren't I? Let's make a statue, right? I don't know if that's what's going on. Maybe it is. But he certainly takes this personally, as we see. Well, that's why this chapter is so important for us. I believe that first century Christians, they probably read this to their children every night, especially when the furnace started getting hot in Rome, right? Because people did die for their faith. And they were living in a pluralistic society where you can worship your own gods and you can pray to your own gods and you can have your religious books and study them so long as the ultimate allegiance goes to the king, goes to Caesar. If you don't burn incense before his image, if you don't pay homage to him, well then, no, that's where we draw the line. There is a similar kind of religious intolerance going on today. And I think you know where I'm going with this. That's why we're talking about postmodernism. What is the only thing as a postmodern believer you can't believe? You can believe anything you want, right? But there's one thing you can't believe. And that one thing is that there is only one God. There's only one truth. And so I believe that what we have in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is a pattern. This is a template. This is a model. These three young men, I believe they're still young at this point, are showing the kind of courage and conviction to go against the tide, to go against the stream. We talked about serving a God who lives upstream. They were willing to fight that and to go in a totally different direction, to stand when everyone else was kneeling. Okay, so how did they survive? We're going to talk about three things. First of all, they survived because they knew what they believed. I read a book before I moved here about what young people believe and what they don't believe. It's called Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood by Christian Smith, who is a sociologist at Notre Dame. Did extensive survey of young people. Actually, it was a longitudinal study from the time that these kids were around 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age on up into their late teens and early adulthood years. He asked them questions and he really interviewed them. And it was hundreds and hundreds of interviews that were conducted to try to get a grasp on where is morality among today's youth. And some of the things that he found were kind of shocking. So one of these interviews, and I'm just going to take an excerpt from a chapter entitled Morality Adrift, talking about kind of the relativism that has overtaken so much of culture and certainly influenced the thinking of young people. He just asked them, so what's right and what's wrong? And how do you determine what's right and what's wrong? And he got lots of different responses to that. I want to read one such response. It's from a young lady who said, "I don't know that people like terrorists, what they do, it's not wrong to them. They're doing the ultimate good. They're just like they're doing the thing that they think is the best thing they could possibly do, and so they're doing good. I had this discussion with a friend recently, and she's like, but they're still murdering tons of people, and that just has to be wrong. And I was like, but do we have any idea if it is actually wrong to murder tons of people? Like, what does that even mean? Earthquakes murder tons of people, and I'm sure that some people believe that God caused the earthquakes, and that means that there were some purpose for them. They'll just never know it. So you could say that people who are terrorists are okay, who somehow get brainwashed or born into cultures where they're taught that it's all right and necessary and really important for them to kill a bunch of people. In the grand scheme of things, that's just because, like, X amount of the population targeted needs to disappear. I don't believe that. But I could see that that could be an argument. So, how do you feel about that? I realize that this is a bit of an extreme example. I don't know how many young people would actually say that. But I've heard things that would take you to the... I mean, she's just drawing some of the logical conclusions of what she's learned, right? How can you say that anything is wrong if there is not absolute truth? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down because they knew that was wrong under any circumstances. Anywhere, any culture, that was wrong. That is emphasized. That's one of the things that is repeated three times, I think I counted up, in the chapter. First of all, these rival Chaldeans who all want the positions that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were given at the end of chapter 1, if you remember. So they come before the king and say, "Hey, king, these men pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." The king then asked them, "Do you worship these gods, serve them?" And they said, "No, we don't worship your gods or serve them." They knew what they believed. This is what I believe is being expressed in the first Psalm. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel, the instruction, the guidance, the philosophy, the wisdom, the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And how is he described? Now, you remember, the ungodly, he says, are like the chaff that the wind blows away. Just a gentle breeze will blow away chaff. But the man who is rooted in the Word of God is like a tree planted by the streams of water. Have you ever run into a tree before by accident? You know, like you're playing, you know, frisbee, or, you know, what ultimate frisbee, or you're playing football, and like you're going out and you're almost there and you don't see, you're looking back and you don't see, and boom, you hit that tree. How hard is that tree? Does it move? I mean, trees can kind of look like they're not all that strong. They're blowing in the wind, swaying. Man, you hit one of those trees, it does not move. And that's what he's saying here about the blessed man who meditates on the law of God. He doesn't listen to the counsel of the wicked. He meditates on the law of God. We're studying, before we get there, Luke chapter 8 and verse 13, the ones on the rock, parable of the sower, are those who, when they hear the word, receive it with joy, but these have no root. They believe for a while, and in time of testing, they fall away. What happens to the stony ground? Well, they're not rooted in the Word of God, and so when trials come, you know, they just burn up, right? The fiery furnace takes them. This is where we're studying Colossians on Thursday night with the college group. Colossians 2, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit according to human tradition." And so how do you insulate against the philosophies that are being taught literally in the university, right? Well, what Paul says is, "Therefore, as you receive Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in Him, rooted and built up in Him and established in the faith, just as you were taught with thanksgiving." So what is the best way? Do we need to have a class on every single false philosophy and religion and fully? No. Know Christ. When you know Him, when you're rooted and built up in Him, it doesn't matter what the philosophers say. You're not going to listen to it because you know what you believe. Secondly, they stood for what they believed. Another chapter... Well, there were chapters in this book by Christian Smith devoted to many different subjects, even politics. But there was a whole chapter given to drinking, right? So how do young people view drinking? And I'm not going to read from one of the quotations about why drink. I want to read to you at the end where he gives kind of his conclusion. He takes all of the evidence, all the data, and draws some conclusions about why young people drink as they do. He wrote, consider, for example, the influence of normative culture. Normative culture. By this we mean the cultural scripts that tell people who are playing specific social roles, such as teenager or college student, how they should think, desire, feel, and behave. Somehow, for some reason, growing up in American culture usually entails being socialized into internalizing the cultural script that says that in middle to late adolescence, one needs to experiment with drinking and smoking and possibly with drugs. That script says that once a person leaves home, they need to exercise their new freedom by partying, acting wild and crazy, perhaps idiotically, particularly by consuming large amounts of alcohol and maybe some drugs. The script also says that eventually in one's late 20s or early 30s, one needs to stop the partying, settle down, and become a good, successful, financially secure family person. When I, Smith, teach Introduction to Sociology, I spend two classes discussing the question, why intoxication? At first, most students cannot even imagine the justification for even asking the question at all. Isn't it obvious? But when I push them, they essentially conclude something like this. Quote, the entire time we were growing up, we were taught that when you get to college, you're supposed to be to party, to be wild, to get crazy, to have fun, to drink a lot. Their answer, in short, is we do exactly what we're told to do. Note that these are otherwise bright people. We're talking about Notre Dame. It's not easy getting into that school, by the way. These are otherwise bright people who profess to be, even insist that they are, autonomous and self-directing individuals, whom it can take a long time to convince sociologically that life is not simply about making individual choices. Yet many party like crazy and suffer the associated hangovers, blackouts, injuries, risky and meaningless hookups, and sometimes substance addictions because, they explain, it's what they have been taught to do in college. In some sense, it is a version of Aristotle's bovine existence being lived out by otherwise very smart and promising young people. Such is the power of cultural norms, socialization, and life course scripting about people's individual choices. And so, that's what we're up against. We're not talking about gently flowing stream. You know, if you go out to the Black Warrior River and you watch it, It's sometimes hard to even see it moving, right? Except lately when we had so many rains, it was moving a little bit faster. We're not talking about that kind of slowly, gently lead you along, float down the river kind of stream. We're talking about rapids, especially when you're thrown into certain contexts like college. Everybody is doing it. Could you imagine? I mean, imagine all those, I don't know, was it hundreds of people? I don't know. All of these very important people, these are not, you know, slaves out there. These are the governors and the prefects and all of these very important high officials in government. And they're all gathered together. And as soon as the music blares, and I can only imagine, music has a powerful effect, by the way. Think about patriotic music that we have. That's kind of the thing that I would assume was being played. And so as soon as this music plays, what does everybody do? Boom, to the floor. And when they knelt, they didn't just kneel. They prostrated themselves. And here are these three guys just standing up. Why did they do that? How were they able to resist the flow of culture? Well, it's because, first of all, they knew what they believed, but they were willing to stand for what they believed. And I just love the way that they responded. They're so polite. This doesn't sound like, you know, some obnoxious young people. Well, I'll tell you a thing or two, you old man. You know, you heathen, you know, pagan, idol worshiper, we're not going to bow down to your God, and, you know, you can just get over it. You know, that's not the way they refer to him at all. We're not going to bow down. But if not, and we realize what the consequence might be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. We need to decide where we stand. Joshua made that challenge at the end of his life. He said, you remember the gods that our fathers worshipped? You know the gods that are around the Canaanites where we've taken this land? You choose. If it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And statements like Paul's at the end of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians. Be watchful, stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be a man. Be a man. Be strong. Don't just go along with what everybody else is doing. And so they knew what they believed. They stood for what they believed. And finally, they trusted in the one whom they believed. They said, if this be so, King, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O King. It's kind of interesting. They seem to be answering both ways. Right? We realize that it may not happen. We may die in this burning fiery furnace, and yet we're going to be delivered. So which is it? I think it's both. They're willing to die, but they realize that even in death, they will be delivered. Remember, they see themselves as exiles. They don't belong here. They belong somewhere else, right? And so God's going to deliver them from his hand either way, either by life or by death. And that's what I think Paul is saying at the end of the great chapter on the resurrection. After laying out all the evidence, explaining the resurrection in different ways, he concludes, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain, never in vain. You may lose your house, you may lose your family, you may lose your job, you may lose everything, including your life. But because he is raised and will be raised with him, you can know for certain that your labor is not in vain. We should live with that kind of victorious mentality, perspective, that the worst thing they can do to us is kill us. That's the worst thing they can do. So, how do we apply a lesson like this? I want to take a few minutes just here at the end and read from Deuteronomy chapter 6. Turn over there really quickly with me. This passage must have been running through the minds of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they were first told, you've got to bow down to this image. This would have been a prayer, the Shema, still today, is taught to young Jewish children to pray. I'm sure their parents, I assume that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had very good parents who taught them the truth. They would have taught them this passage. But it says in verse 4, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. There is no other God, that means. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. You notice that right after this climactic statement that the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and this Lord needs to be the very first priority in your life, loving him with all that you have. Notice what he says. Teach this to your children. Teach this to your children. I believe, though I don't know this, I believe that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had very good parents who did this. It's the only way I can explain this, honestly. They taught them these things. So I want to make just a few applications for parents. First of all, make Bible study a priority. A priority. Start when your children are young. I believe nightly rituals are wonderful times to start indoctrinating our children. Prayer, a few verses, Bible story books, begin as soon as they are aware of what is going on in the world. Before they're even verbal. Begin this with the songs, the prayers. As they grow up to become young readers, Get them in the habit of reading the Bible every day. There's books that have been written, Bible story books made for young readers. I can recommend some to you. Adrian could. Get them day by day reading the Word of God. As they grow up and become adolescents, it becomes much more challenging. Understand, I know, having children that have been involved in sports and music and different things, it becomes much more challenging when they're older. But this still, listen, this still must be the priority. And what you'll be surprised from your adolescent children is they want this more than you think they do. And I'm afraid that too often parents are a little more motivated toward all of the extracurricular than their children. Their children get worn out. They just say, oh, psh, you know, I'm tired of soccer. We've seen that again and again. But you'll be surprised how welcome this will be to have a family night where nothing's on, all the devices turned off, it's just you and a Bible and your kids. How they will love you for making that a commitment. Lead by example. Notice he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And then teach this to your children. It has to first be in you. And they need to see you make bold stands. To stand up and say, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And that's it. No compromise. No compromise. They need to see us have that kind of conviction. Act like men. Men, be the father. Don't be afraid to be the bad guy in your home. And then stay connected. I love what verse 7 says. You shall teach them diligently to your children. When? When they go to church? No, that's not what he talks about here. Shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. Now, I think what's implied there is that families are going to be together in that way. But honestly, that is not a part of our world naturally. Naturally, years ago, you were out in the field together, you got up together, you ate breakfast and biscuits, you went out in the field, you worked, you came in for lunch, you worked some more. Families were together by necessity. You needed all 14 children out there in the fields, right? You know, so you were just together all the time. It's not that way. You have to be much more intentional to have those opportunities as you walk by the way. And let's just say, I think boredom is not a bad thing all the time. Now, I am a huge... I remember when we first got our little... we didn't have a van that was equipped with, you know, the flip-down screen. We bought a little VCR thing where we could pop it in and stick it in between the seats and amuse the kids as we went on these long, long hours and hours and hours journey. But you know what? The kids don't have to be entertained all the time. And some of those long, boring car trips can be wonderful opportunities to talk where we're unplugged. And, you know, he doesn't talk about driving, by the way, walking, by the way, but those boring walks can be wonderful times to connect, to find out what's going on in our children's lives, and then to integrate what we believe into those discussions. Be aware, I'm going to skip this one, but let me just say very briefly, as an anecdote, we sent our kids to public school, and one day, I think it was Anna, came home and told us that her teacher, who was a substitute, to be fair, a substitute came in and said, recommended that everyone go home and watch 50 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey. Jonathan didn't even consider putting that into his lesson this morning. That's just, oh, what are you talking about? Be aware. Be aware of what your kids, and I called the principal, and he was not happy either. Be aware of what's going on in their lives. And then finally, give them roots and wings. Eventually, they need to make their own choices. And that's a scary thing as a parent. But we can't totally shield them and guard them from everything that is wrong. Eventually, they have to go to Babylon themselves. And so let's prepare them while they're young. As they're able, not saying just throw them to the wolves. let them watch whatever kind of movie they want to watch. No, we don't do that. But at the same time, we need to give them freedom to make their own moral choices and even make mistakes so that they can learn to stand on their own. I've gone over a few minutes. I don't apologize, but you're probably wishing Jonathan were up here this morning. This is important. Guys, this is important. And even those of you that are not married and don't have kids, I want you to think about this. How important this is. It's critically important. And so I want to conclude just where the story leaves off, with the king just totally amazed at what had happened. The way the king interpreted this, he says, God had sent his angel to deliver them. Is that true? Was it an angel? Some have suggested it was Jesus, a pre-incarnate, you know, Son of God there with them. I don't know. But there were four people there in the burning fiery furnace. And the one, from the king's perspective, was divine. Not of this world. That's the promise, that's the hope that we have as children of God, is that whatever trial we go through, we are not going through it alone. We have our Savior with us. Our God does not leave us or forsake us. And if you're not a child of God, that's not the hope that you have. You are in this world, as crazy and dark and scary as it is, you're in this world by yourself, without God. And so, if this is what you need, if this is what you want, why not come this morning? We make this invitation to come and receive the blessing of knowing that your prayers are heard by God with Jesus interceding for you because his blood has covered you and washed you of every stain. So if you're not a Christian, why not decide this morning to come to him, to repent, be baptized, and you can have this hope as we stand and sing.